we're going to get started with our tax committee meeting today. And I know we've had some folks that missed part of the last meeting. If there's specific questions you want to bring up, I'm sure Ms. Sutton would be happy to answer them. Otherwise, she's going to pick up where she left off.
So I'm back on.
Members, again, we're going through the PowerPoint and handout that you have in your folders, hopefully in your saves file. I've got down about slide number 44, 45. I think Ms. Dalton is where we ended last time. Okay. And the pages do have extras if you don't have your handouts, but I think just about everybody did last time. So, Ms. Dalton, whenever you're ready.
Do we have any more of those?
But there's going to be some that I think the pages do have extra copies. So. Whenever you're ready, Ms. Dalton, again, members, we want to have discussion and questions. This is overview-based buildings, so feel free to let me know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton from House Research. We are on page 15 of the handout of slides, and we are starting on slide 45, which is just the sales tax base. Hopefully, we will go through a few more slides a little bit more quickly than we did yesterday. Sales taxes, in theory, is a tax on final consumption. Minnesota has a relatively narrow tax base. Generally, goods are taxable unless specifically exempted, and services are usually not taxable unless specifically included. So when you're going, why is this taxed? Why is that not taxed? If it's a service, it's taxed because there's been a conscious decision to tax it. If it's a good that's exempt, it's because somebody has, the legislature has actually passed an exemption for it. A number
Would you make that point again? I think that's an important point.
If a service is taxed, it's because the legislature has made the conscious decision to tax it. And if the good is exempt, it's because the legislature has made the conscious decision to exempt it.
Thank you.
Although this is supposed to be a tax on final consumption, we tax a number of intermediate business inputs. Probably the biggest business intermediate input that we don't tax is capital equipment, and you're all aware of the capital equipment exemption. But there's a number of things that we do tax that businesses buy. About 44% of the sales tax revenue is actually on business inputs. Although, you know, you need to remember that although 44% of the tax is paid by the business, this is passed on to individuals, shareholders, employers, and consumers through prices and wages. Minnesota has a relatively narrow tax base. Most base expansion has occurred during the state fiscal crisis. The largest expansion that has occurred in the sales tax occurred in 1987 when we added a number of services and admissions to recreational facilities. We also added non-prescription drugs at that time, car washing, dry cleaning, parking, building cleaning, things like that. Major exemptions. Everyone's very familiar with probably the first two major exemptions from the sales tax, food for home consumption and clothing. We also exempt home heating fuels. Motor fuels are exempt from the sales tax, although they are subject to the gas tax instead. All drugs for human consumption are exempt. That one is a recent change. At one time, we only exempted prescription drugs and aspirin. But the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, doesn't allow us to treat aspirin differently from other over-the-counter medications like cough syrup. And so when we were conforming with the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement, the decision was made to exempt all over-the-counter as well as prescription drugs. Newspaper and subscription magazines are exempt from sales tax. And the last one on this slide, cigarettes. The cigarette exemption was enacted in 2005, but cigarettes are now subject to a per-pack tax based on average price instead. And the reason they exempted it and then put a different tax on it is the Department of Revenue felt that there was some problems with collecting the sales tax on cigarettes, and this was actually a way to get more compliance. As I said, we tax a lot of business inputs, but there are some major exemptions for business and farms, capital equipment, farm machinery, direct inputs to agricultural and industrial production, and certain direct inputs for some of the taxable services. And the taxable services that have their inputs exempt are the ones that we expanded, we included in the sales tax base in 1987, and you'll commonly hear them referred to as the 1987 services. Other major sales tax exemptions relate to local governments and nonprofits. And we began in 1992. We began taxing local government purchases, except local government purchases of high schools, and that was done as a trade-off between cutting aid to local governments or imposing the tax. And the decision was made to impose the tax. Since 1992, we've been kind of chipping away at that, at taxing local governments. The big thing has been in the area of firefighting equipment, library purchases, nursing homes, and some of the other public safety equipment are no longer subject to the sales tax. There are sales to nonprofit charitable organizations and certain sales by nonprofit charitable organizations that are also exempt. Page 28 of the really large handout actually has a list of a number of the exemptions and gives a rough estimate of what would be raised if tax base was broadened by repealing some of these exemptions. And those exemptions and those that information comes from the Department of Revenue tax expenditure budget. One issue that's always a perennial issue in sales tax is the sales tax as it applies to remote sales. The state cannot constitutionally impose a duty to collect sales tax on remote sellers that do not have a physical presence in the state. They don't have an employee, they don't have a building, they don't have, you know, any types of facilities. However, Congress can impose a duty to collect on remote sellers because they have the ability to regulate interstate commerce. So far, they haven't done that. What does this mean for the state? Well, state revenue losses from retail remote sales is estimated to be about $204 million in 2011. About $149 million of that is due to electronic commerce, and $55 million of it is kind of what we consider a traditional remote sales, catalog sales. What's interesting about that is that the electronic commerce tax loss has grown by 300% between 2004 and the estimate for 2011. Catalog, on the other hand, the revenue loss has only grown by 20%. So electronic commerce is the thing that's really driving this loss from remote sales. There's a number of Supreme Court cases, most recently Crowell versus North Dakota, that basically says remote sellers cannot be required to collect sales tax because it's an undue burden on interstate commerce.
We've got a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, I just wanted to go back. We're talking about the remote sales and clarify. The losses from the retail remote sales, are we talking about sellers in Minnesota who are selling to people outside the state, or the other way around, or both?
Mr. Chair, that's a kind of leeway. I got it right this time. We are talking about sales made two people in the state from businesses located outside of the state. And one of the things I want to make clear is that this is just retail sales. These are sales to individuals. There's also a tax gap in sales not paid by businesses. And There's not a really good estimate of how much of that is due to remote sales, but they, the Department of Revenue thinks that that's a fairly substantial number as well. So this is just the sales to individuals. The number related to e-commerce is actually larger because there's also business-to-business sales that are not being taxed because of the electronic commerce.
Ms. Salt, again, the figures for the online sales was 150.
It is 149 million, and that's a 300% increase since 2004.
Thank you.
So, how are we trying to deal with this? A number of states got together to try to reduce the burden of the sale of collecting sales tax on interstate commerce, because that's, of course, what the Supreme Court said is the problem. Why we can't tax them is because it's an undue burden. So the way the states tried to reduce the burden is by simplifying and standardizing the sales tax law across the state. And that led to what is known as the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. You'll hear us refer to it as SSCTA. You'll hear us refer to it as SSPP. You'll hear us refer to it just as Streamlined. This is an agreement to simplify and streamline administration and collection between the states. The main simplifications include standard rules about rates, about where you source a sale, about registration, and the thing that has been probably the hardest and the thing that we've been dealing with most often in this committee has been establishing common definitions of goods and services used by the states in defining their tax base. The Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement doesn't require you to tax something or exempt something, but it does say that you have to use their definitions in defining what is taxable and not taxable. And for people who have been around for, you know, for the last decade, they may be aware, Minnesota was one of the first states to actually adopt this, try to conform to this agreement, and we kind of became the guinea pig. And we did run into a few problems, particularly as it related to what is prepared food. We tax prepared food in this state. And the first problem we ran into was how we taxed bread. We didn't tax bread in grocery stores, but we taxed bread sold in bakeries. And so we actually had to go back to Streamlined Sales Tax Group, project group, and do the definition change so we could treat bread as bread. And then we also had to do the same thing with meat. we did become kind of the guinea pig, and it was a little... It was a little uncomfortable for us to hear. We are one of the first states to conform. Currently, there are 19 states in compliance with the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement, and there are another 3 states that will be in compliance with the agreement come July 1 of this year. So that would then be 22 states out of the 45 states that have sales taxes. The New Jersey governor just actually announced in the paper recently that he is considering moving New Jersey into compliance, and that would be a really big state to add to this group. So, unless there are other questions about streamlined sales tax,
Representative Dieter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not totally understand this at all, but under the Streamlined Sales Tax Use and Tax Agreement in our state and in Minnesota, it still says, though, that if you have bricks and mortar in the state, that you are taxed, but if you do not, then you are not taxed, and you ship goods into, you're producing the same goods, but you ship them in, you are not taxed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, actually let's take a step back to this state has what most states have, which is a sales and use tax. You're subject to the sales tax, and retailers are supposed to collect it. But if retailers do not collect the tax, you are actually obligated to pay a complementary use tax, which is equivalent to the sales tax. Businesses pay this all the time. And we actually audit businesses to make sure that they are doing this. It's very difficult to audit every individual to make sure that they are paying use tax on the purchases that they make that the retailer did not collect the tax on. So the tax is due regardless of where you purchase or who you purchase something from. The problem is we can make the retailer collect the tax if they have a physical presence in the state. We can't make them collect their tax if they do not have a physical presence in the state. And then the burden of collecting the tax actually falls on the purchaser. Now, this state actually has what's called a de minimis exemption for individuals. You may purchase up to $770 a year of taxable goods that the retailer did not collect the sales tax on, and you don't have to file a use tax return. And this is trying to decriminalize all of us who, you know, buy a few things over the catalog. On the other hand, if you're buying, you know, a $1,000 computer from Dell over the internet, you should be paying use tax. And if you look at your income tax form, which we're all going to be looking at shortly, you will actually see in the instructions this great big box that talks about use tax and how to file it, and that you should owe it if you are making these purchases. Does that help?
That
I understand it clearly now. Okay, and Mr. Chairman, if I may, I know that there are some, at least, bricks and mortar companies in the state of Minnesota who feel like that this is a huge disadvantage to them doing business in the state, and it actually penalizes businesses for having bricks and mortar in the state. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, that's correct. There have been a number of, I mean, the whole reason to do this is to either have Congress, hopefully, regulate interstate commerce and impose the duty to collect on interstate sellers. That's the whole reason all the states are doing this streamlined sales and use tax agreement. And it's why Minnesota has been one of the leaders in this area. Is eventually we'd like Congress, and there have been a number of bills introduced into Congress. I think one of them was actually called the Main Street Business Support Bill or something like that, to basically say, you know, if states, remote sellers will have a duty to collect in states that have simplified their sales tax laws. So that's the whole reason why we're doing this. It is an unfair, it is an advantage to remote sellers. I mean, the reason Amazon.com doesn't want to collect the sales tax, and Amazon.com has had a tendency to locate its facilities in states that don't have sales taxes, is to avoid collecting the sales tax, and it then makes their prices lower.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Baldwin, just a quick follow up, and I know we've got a couple other members with questions. Why is it then that some states do, I mean, if you order something online, you'll get the pop up window that says if you're in X, Y, and Z state, add an additional whatever sales tax?
Mr. Chair, the reason is they have a physical presence in that state. They either have a warehouse, a manufacturing representative, somebody in that state.
Okay.
And so they collect it. One of the things that's also really interesting about the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement is, being a member of it, there is a voluntary registration provision in it, and if you register voluntarily under it, the reason businesses register voluntarily under it is basically they're given amnesty for past behavior. So it's a way of saying, well, maybe we should have been collecting tax on that, but, you know, going forward, we're going to start collecting. But if you sign up under this voluntary agreement, you must collect tax in all of the states in the agreement, whether you have a physical presence in them or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm looking to see if revenue is here. I did actually get a number of what they think they are collecting from this. If I can find it really quickly.
I'm being told, Ms. Dalton, slide
51.
Yeah,
you're
right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You did.
I just need to get the right state and the right slide. We're collecting about $22 million voluntarily because of the agreement. We've had we've got that much in sales tax revenue from people who have registered under the voluntary provision. I just didn't go on to my next slide.
Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Who is the voting member here on your slide 51? Is that the Commissioner of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Now the there are three members who split the vote for Minnesota. The Commissioner of Revenue is one vote, and these House and Senate taxpayers or their representative represents the other vote.
That's comfy.
All heads turn. Thank you, Ms. Alden. Representative Fulbert.
There was just a recent New York State court case that talked about the presence of a company. We've always been defining it as brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. But in that, Amazon had one person that was an employee. I think it was the Amazon company. It might have been some other one, but they had one employee present in the state. And the state Supreme Court has ruled in New York that made a presence. They didn't have to be bricks and mortar. And so there was a bill I think will be probably introduced tomorrow. I'm chief author and others are signed on to it as well to implement that in Minnesota as well. I don't know how much it raises, but it'd be getting interesting. Maybe nothing, but we're going to try to look at it underneath every rock.
Ms. Baltimore, I saw your head nodding.
Mr. Chair, there have been work. It's an ongoing process to try to get these email sellers to collect. Several years ago, Minnesota passed what's called an affiliate nexus provision that basically said if you have an affiliate in the state, you are subject to the tax. This is a way to get to like the Cabela's.com versus Cabela's or BarnesandNobles.com versus, with Barnes & Noble because they were set up as affiliates. What New York did is that they're actually looking at if you are contracting with bloggers who are in your state to essentially direct traffic to your website, those are your agents. And those agents will count for nexus purpose. And that is essentially the bill that Representative Silbert is talking about.
Thank you, Ms. Baldwin. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, 750.
How do you arrive at the number to 750?
And then is that a cumulative number?
It's my
understanding.
I'm not sure how
to count it. No, I actually haven't answered this. I remember I had a discussion when you were somebody many years ago about this. And then is the first $750 a chance for your example of $1,000 when you pay the sales tax on the amount above $750, or do you, if you hit that threshold in your example of $1,000, you pay the sales tax on the full $1,000? I'm just trying to get a feel for how that all works, and like Representative Fulbert just said, we're looking under every rock here, I think, of course. It's over, but those three points, why the 750 is the cumulative, and you pay on the $4,000
portion above and beyond. And it was 770, right?
77.
770.
Even standard number.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, $770 is equivalent to a $50 sales tax bill. And so that's essentially the way it's drafted as you're exempt on $50 worth of sales tax obligation. As soon as you accumulate at least $50 of sales tax accumulation, you owe all the sales tax. That $50 isn't a freebie once you're over it. So if you purchase something for $1,000, you would owe sales, $665 of sales tax.
You would owe on the entire
purchase. Right, on the entire purchase.
And then, Mr. Chairman, a cumulative number, is that per purchase or cumulatively? In other words, instead of an analyst, keep their record for the year when they file their income tax and add up all of their purchases, or do they convert that $750 per purchase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it is for, it's an annual number. So it's a cumulative number over the course of a year. The reality is, we still aren't going to go out and audit lots of individuals on individual use tax. On the other hand, we do use, the department does use things like import records and things like that. If you're importing China from England, they're going to send you a little letter saying, you just bought, you know, $2,000 of Wedgwood China, you owe us use tax. So, you know, the same thing may be happening with electronics. So, basically, the minimum provision was actually passed in the middle 1990s as part of, at that time, there was a sales tax group that was meeting, a joint legislative commission looking at sales taxes, and this was actually one of the recommendations of, you know, most of us make some purchases, you know, either out of state or online or through a catalog, and, you know, everybody shouldn't be a criminal just because they aren't paying the use tax on a minor thing. However, nobody wanted it, you know, the use tax to go away if you are purchasing large things because, you know, otherwise we're giving an advantage to out-of-state retailers.
Mm-hmm. Representative Fulbert?
Well, that last comment, I think, is, Mr. Chair, was the most important aspect of this, and then that is to have the Main Street retailer not be at a disadvantage for internet sales or other things. And if we probably don't raise much money, but if we at least are helping to protect the Main Street and our own business people, that's the most important goal of this.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Albert, can I continue?
There are no more questions on Streamline. This is actually not a state tax, but we're going to do it with the sales taxes because this hasn't been a big issue. Local sales taxes. In 1971, as part of the Minnesota Miracle, the state reformed the state aid system for local governments and essentially set up all these, you know, state aid programs. As part of that, or in return for providing fairly generous state aid to local governments, there was a prohibition put in place for local governments from that prohibited local governments from imposing local sales or income taxes, unless they had already imposed them prior to 1972. That law act, so therefore all local sales taxes have to have a special law before they can be imposed. The state was pretty good about actually kind of holding to that. There were only 5 local sales taxes prior to 1993. And then times got tight and local governments started coming in for sales taxes. By 2000, we had 10 local sales taxes. And since 2000, we have enacted a number of them, and we now have 23 cities in the state and one county that currently impose a sales tax. Actually, 24 cities and one county. 23 cities impose the sales tax at a half cent. Duluth is the only city that has a 1% rate, and Hennepin County imposes a tax of 15% on the Twins ballpark. I mean, 0.15%.
Sorry.
We would have that ballpark paid for it like
anything. Did you bother that?
That's Ballpark tax bill.
I like it.
last year, we also passed some transit taxes. A voluntary tax for the 7 counties in the metro area up to 0.25% to pay for transit. This was imposed by Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. So 5 out of the 7 counties did impose it. Some things to know about them. Generally speaking, local tax, and I'm saying generally now because as we add more, they get less and less like us. Generally speaking, local taxes are required to pay for bricks and mortar projects, not for ongoing operations. Duluth is an exception. Depending on how you look at transit, I would say transit is also an exception. With the exception of Duluth and the transit taxes, all of the local taxes have an expiration condition on them. Most of them have a condition that's really set to a date or to an amount raised. A few of them are a little more wishy-washy. The Minneapolis one is related to when the bonds are paid off in the convention center, except that they keep issuing new bonds, so they never quite get there. But there is at least some indication that they should end at some time. There is also open local sales tax authority. The two counties in the metro area that did not impose the transit tax this year still have the option of doing it in the future, and all it takes is their local governments, their county boards, to pass a resolution saying they're going to impose it. The other part of the local sales taxes that was in the transportation bill last year is the transportation bill allowed all other counties, all the greater Minnesota counties, to impose a 5%, half a cent, I've got to quit doing this, a half cent local sales tax for transportation. To do that, they must identify the project and they must get voter approval. At this point, no outstate county has taken advantage of this authority. Also, Cook County had a local sales tax which expired last year, and they were granted brand new authority this year, at the end of the 2008 session, to impose it again. They haven't imposed it yet, but they can. And the city of Winona also was granted authority to impose a tax. Both of those taxes do require voter approval.
Before we switch over to Mr. Michael, on the subject of sales tax, I know one of the issues that I've been asked about that I'll admit I don't understand completely is the refund that we give businesses on capital purchases. Can you just, and I'm sorry members, this is only for me, but if you could do a little 30-second synopsis on that before we leave the sales tax issue.
Capital equipment is one of the exemptions in our law, and there are a few others, but basically the business is required to pay the sales tax on the capital equipment up front, and then they apply for a refund. And they have to provide a lot of documentation with that refund. The refund may take 6 months before they actually get it. They can only apply for a refund twice a year. So every time they buy it, they don't immediately apply for a refund. They pretty much gather up all their capital equipment purchases and then do, you know, one every 6 months or one a year. Why do we do this? How did we get into this mess? The reason we got into this mess is that initially all capital equipment was taxable. And then the legislature passed a provision that said capital equipment used for new or expanding businesses would be exempt. But how do you define expansion versus replacement? And to do that, essentially, you need to be able to document that this wasn't merely replacement, this was actually expansion. And so what happened was they made that exemption you pay and then you apply for the refund so that they could actually do the documentation to ensure that this was really truly an expansion and not just a replacement of existing capital equipment. The original law was actually a reduced rate. It also wasn't a full exemption. It was 2% lower. During the 90s, we actually kept lowering that rate, and we kept expanding what was included in the exemption. And I think it was 97 or 98, where we actually finally made all capital equipment for industrial production exempt. But it was going to cost money to make it an upfront exemption. And it's over and above the cost of just including everybody. And the money wasn't there, or they chose not to use the money. And so that's why people are still paying for it and then applying for a refund. And as you probably noticed in the governor's recommendation, he's recommending that you go up front, and there is a cost. There's like a $37 million cost in the first year, a $47 million cost in the second year, and that's because of the delays in when those refunds are made. And then there's an ongoing cost, and the ongoing cost is related to the fact that there's a belief that there's a number of small businesses that simply are not jumping through the hoops to get their capital equipment exemption right now, because it is a fairly onerous process. And so if you make it an upfront exemption, this will actually benefit particularly small businesses who will no longer have to jump through that hoop.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, maybe a few interrelated questions. You said that local sales taxes generally are required to be used for bricks and mortar. Is there then in the enabling legislation, well, first, is that in statute, and then in the enabling legislation, is there a specific exception to that? And somewhat related, my understanding is that there's a voter referendum requirement for locally imposed sales taxes, with perhaps a jurisdiction that is somehow above a million people exempted from that. Could you just cover those topics with relation to sales tax, local sales taxes?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative. The local sales tax, there is a statute related to local sales tax. It's in Chapter 297A, it's 297A.99. And basically, it codified what had become standard practice in granting these local sales tax authorities. As I said, they all require a special law, because the law has to say, notwithstanding the general prohibition, you can do this. And what we had done is, several years ago, was to actually codify kind of the general provisions, so we didn't have to keep repeating them in every bill. It shortens up every local sales tax bill, because you can just say, and you're subject to all the requirements of Chapter 297A.99. So what are those requirements? One is that you hold a referendum. One, that the two, that the project be for a specific project that has been identified at least 6 months in advance and is described in the referendum. Third one is that it have a expiration date. Then there are requirements about when it can be imposed to match some streamlined requirements about we can only change tax rates on calendar quarters, and you have to give so much notice before you do changes. So that's all in the statute. It's not constitutional, as I always remind people, so there's nothing that says you can't say, notwithstanding 297A.99, you can do it this way. So the statutory language is really guidelines, and generally we hope people follow them, but we've certainly written bills that have not followed all the provisions in that statute.
Thank you.
And this is a really, for new members to the committee, a really controversial set of issues and very strong feelings on both sides. And then, of course, resentments for folks who didn't get to have a vote and those who did, and all these sort of exceptions and all that stuff. So the laundry list runs deep in this committee, and it's not partisan. It's kind of people all over the map, and there's been a lot of fights for those who've been on this committee for a while, big fights on these issues. Ms. Dalton, without picking a side, can you kind of just cover for people, you know, what is the core controversy? I mean, I think it's no surprise to people here that the two taxpayers in this room are opposed these. But can you talk about the history when LGA was brought in, the assumption that there would no longer be these, and that was what LGA was saying, and just kind of, you know, why do some cities want them, and then what's the disparity issue and the, you know, kind of the making wealthier cities wealthier and poor? Because I think it's important for people to step out of their personal world and kind of hear the theory behind why local option sales taxes drive people crazy on this committee, both pro and con. We have strong advocates and opponents to this issue.
I just add, Madam Chair, to that series of questions from Ms. Dalton, also the exploitation of the tax, I think, would be an important thing to talk about, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a lot of questions to try to answer. A little history. As I said, the prohibition against local sales taxes went in effect in 1972, along with the Minnesota Miracle. And as a matter of fact, it was actually a subdivision written into the local government aid statute. So it was very clearly tied at that point to The state is going to give local governments a whole bunch of general purpose aid, and in return, you are not going to impose these local taxes. The policy behind it. Local government aid, at least one purpose of local government aid is to provide equity in ability to fund local services across the state. There's a fairly large disparity in tax base between cities in this state, as I think most of you are aware. And so local government aid was an attempt to equalize that. Well, the problem is if you add other taxes, you are again expanding the inequities in ability to raise revenue across the state. The example I always use is who cares, city, Bloomington, if it imposed a local sales tax, could probably come pretty close to wiping out its entire property tax because it has a lot of retail. Burnsville's another place. The regional centers are another place. So if you allow everybody to impose a local sales tax, you are going to increase the inequity and ability to fund local government services. Then your alternative is to think about, well, how do we change, LGA to reflect that? There was a memo I did for this committee a couple of years ago, and I can find it and dig it out and hand it out again, that basically took a look at what other states do. And of the 10 states that provide more than $100 per capita in general purpose aid, only one state allows general local sales tax authority. Of the 20 states that have general local sales tax authority, I think there's, I think the highest aid per capita that anyone gets is about $10. I think 17 of them give nothing to their local government. So it's a trade-off between autonomy and equity. And that's a policy trade-off that you as legislators need to make some decisions about.
Exporting.
One of the arguments for local sales taxes is that particularly in regional centers in greater Minnesota, they've tended to use this argument the most. They often are building things and providing services that are used by people outside of the city limits. So there are regional projects that might deserve regional support from people who don't live in the city. And so a local sales tax is a way to get that type of regional support. So libraries have been funded that way. Certain airports have been funded that way because there was, even though the airport or the library might be provided by the city or paid for by the city, the actual people using it often comes from a greater area. And so then that becomes an argument for why you might want to allow a local sales tax for a project of regional significance. Of course, one of the questions becomes, how do you define a project of regional significance? The legislature actually directed the Department of Revenue to look at this a couple of years ago and do a report. And they said, yeah, we agree, regional significance. We can't, haven't quite figured out what that is yet. So that has been an ongoing issue.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Let's see, another question for Mr. Michael, if you want to start.
Turning now to, and I'll try to finish the rest of the state tax presentation in the time remaining. We're now on the minor taxes. The first one is the corporate franchise tax, which the most people think of as the corporate income tax. Important thing to note about this, in terms of who it applies to in the tax base, you can divide the business world, business organizational world, into three basic categories. You have C corporations and S corporations, and those letters refer to subchapters of the Internal Revenue Code. And then the third category is partnerships. And partnerships include a whole host of other entities. So, for example, limited liability companies are often taxed as partnerships. So those, that's your three basic categories of tax types of entities. The corporate franchise tax applies mainly or only to C corporations, with a few limited exceptions that I'll get into later. And the tax base is their net income, or it's easier to think about that as profits. So that's what the corporate franchise basically applies to. Now, with all state taxes, we can only tax income or activity that's fairly attributable to Minnesota under constitutional provisions. And obviously, many of these businesses, all of the very biggest taxpayers under this, operate in many states. So you have to have a mechanism for determining how much of their total national or international multinational income is attributable to the state. All states do this using what's called formula apportionment. The traditional way it was done was with equally weighted three-factor property, payroll, and sales apportionment. Minnesota was a little unusual in that it allowed the option of a weighted sales formula. Now, as I'll talk about a little later, the trend is toward going to single sales. Minnesota's on that path. Our current proportions under the formula are 84% sales and 8% for the other two factors, property and payroll. And that the apportionment formula is probably the most important feature of the corporate tax. And so it's always useful to keep thinking about the corporate tax in the context of that apportionment formula. The tax rate is 9.8%. In addition to the tax base and the rates, there are a number of credits that are allowed by Minnesota. The biggest of those is the research credit. This parallels the federal research, or what's often referred to as the R&D credit, that allows companies to increase the amount of research that they do over a base amount to get a percentage of that back as a credit against the tax paid. We also have a little bit of an unusual feature in Minnesota, that there's a very limited credit for taxes paid to other states. This only relates to instances where you have income that's taxed in two states. Now, formula apportionment normally says that shouldn't occur because every state's using a formula. But there's another category of income, which is called non-business income, that can be taxed 100% by the state in which the corporation is domiciled. States have conflicting rules on what's business and non-business income. Minnesota has taken the approach of saying, we're going to tax everything as much as the Constitution allows us as business income, whereas other states don't. And what this credit for taxes paid to other states does, it says that if you're taxed 100% on some income in another state, we'll give you a credit for that income against our tax because the formula apportionment did not work. The other credits that are allowed is the enterprise zone credit and Job Z. Also, there's a credit under Job Z for corporations and an exemption for Job Z. Second thing is, there is also, which is not on any on the slide, there is a alternative minimum tax that applies to corporations that roughly parallels the federal alternative minimum tax. This is a fairly minor tax. I think it generates typically less than $10 million a year. Finally, there's a minimum fee, and this is where these non-C corporation businesses actually are subject to the corporate franchise tax in a minimal way. This minimum fee is an add-on fee, it's not an alternative, and it's based on, and it ranges from $100 for the smaller businesses to up to $5,000 for the larger, and it depends upon the amount of factors that you have in Minnesota. So if you have over $20 million in property, payroll, and sales in Minnesota, you pay the top minimum fee of $5,000. If you have less than $500,000 of property, payroll, and sales in Minnesota, you're not subject to the minimum fee. But this does apply to S-corps and partnerships, which are pass-through entities and are not taxed under the corporate franchise tax at all. Their shareholders pay only one level of tax at the individual income level. And that's actually an important point to always keep in mind in thinking about the corporate franchise tax, that there's sort of a two-layer of tax that's involved to business owners that are involved with C corporations, which is not true for businesses that operate as S corps or partnerships. So in other words, the entity pays a tax on its income, and then when it pays dividends or otherwise gets the income to its shareholders, then the individual income tax is paid on that on those dividends by the shareholders. So S corporations and partnerships have a big advantage over C corporations, and as a result of that, we've seen over the last 20 years a dramatic growth in the amount of businesses that operate as S corporations and partnerships. And that just reflects the natural desire to avoid this double layer of taxation. It's coming so that the corporate franchise tax largely applies to publicly held corporations, corporations that have their stocks traded on stock exchanges, which do not have the option, an easy option, of operating as pass-through entities.
So, Michael, we've got a question. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, aren't we one of the only a very few states, though, that we're talking about looking at everything? I think we're one of only a handful that don't have the throwback sales rule, and that would amount to, I have no idea how much money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, Minnesota, this is, Representative Mullery has raised one of the details of the apportionment formula and how that's calculated. Minnesota does not use, and this relates to how you define the sales factor. And the sales factor is, so just so everybody understands, this, we're trying to calculate a percentage to determine a business, how much of a business's income is attributable to a state. And one of the ways we do that, if let's make it easy and we'll assume that we're to the point where we're at 100% sales, you would say, okay, let's look at the amount of your sales in Minnesota as a fraction of your total sales, and that's the percentage of your income that we're going to say is fairly attributable to Minnesota that we're going to tax. So let's say 10% of your sales were to Minnesota purchasers and 90% were to non-Minnesota purchasers. In that case, 10% of your profits would be taxable to Minnesota. What Representative Mullery raises is that under what's called the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, or UDIPA is the acronym that's used, the default rule on the sales was all of these sales are based on destination. So if you look, where does the purchaser's where is the purchaser located? And if the purchaser is located outside the state, then that sale is assigned to that location outside the state. Well, the Uniform Act goes farther and it says, well, we're going to look at a second factor. And we're going to, if that sale is made to a state where you, the corporation that's selling to that purchaser, does not have nexus, therefore we know that other state can't tax the income that's attributable to that sale. So that, let's say the corporation does not have any employees, doesn't have any property, and hasn't taken actions that would otherwise subject them to tax in that other state. What the Uniform Act says in that case, we're going to throw that sale back into the formula and we're going to treat it as a sale of Minnesota in this case, rather than a sale to the state that you're selling it at, where the purchaser is actually located. And the Uniform Act also has that rule for purchases by the federal government, because it's not clear exactly where the federal government would be located. So what that does is it would put more sales as Minnesota sales, increase that percentage, and increase the amount of taxable income. As to Representative Mullery's question about how many states do this, I think that there are a substantial number of states that do it. Mainly they were states that adopted the Uniform Act, which Minnesota never did. But certainly the most common rule is the Minnesota rule, which is to not treat them as Minnesota sales and throw it back. But there are a number of other states that still have throwback rules. North Dakota, for example, I believe one of the uniform states. Now, one of the reasons why, I'll go to that later. But anyway, this next slide goes to revenue. The couple of things to note about the revenue. For FY09, we're assuming it's going to raise about $800 million. Dollars. That's about 5% of the general fund tax revenues. The important thing about those sources of revenue is that this is, of the major taxes, it's the most volatile of our sources of revenue. And on the slide, you can see the difference, the big swings in the tax. In 2002, that was during a recession before, it raised about $500 million. In 2007, which is during the expansion, it raised $1.2 billion. So it doubled over that period. Now, the finance department in its latest forecast is projecting it's going to get cut in half again. So during this recession, we're assuming that the finance department is forecasting a 50% drop in revenues from this tax. And actually, in the February forecast, that may well get worse.
Mr. Reifel, question. Chairman Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is, you know, that drop that we all saw in the forecast that the corporate franchise tax is going to raise half the revenue it raised in 07? You know, if you factor in the FOC changes that became law, does this actually represent an even bigger loss? Because wouldn't have that would have brought in maybe $100 million on the plus side, right? So it's even a bigger loss than 50% if FOC is in pass, or is that not a fair representation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winchesky, that's a very good point. These numbers do not reflect law changes. And so the FOC changes that were enacted by the legislature last year are included in that estimate of roughly $600 million for FY2010. Had that not been included, that number would be even lower. So the fact that we're expecting a 50% drop is including those additional revenues from FOCs. And I don't know, you know, without redoing that forecast, it could very well be that it would have dropped by another $90 million or something like that, or $70 million. So, yes, that points out even more that this is even more volatile.
Thank you.
The state, as I indicated, is implementing single sales over the next 6 years. As I indicated, now we're at 84%, and by tax year 2014, with no change, we'll be at 100%. And the rationale for this is to essentially provide an incentive for corporations to invest here. It's very useful to think about this tax really as a tax on the factors, because as we went through as examples, it's really that's what drives for multi-state corporations what their tax burden is, assuming they have profits, of course. If they don't have profits, they don't pay the tax. But if they have profits, what their factors are is really the crucial thing. And a number of public finance economists have pointed out it's really more useful to think about this as a tax on the factors. And so when you make the tax a tax only on sales, it essentially becomes a consumption-style tax. And so a business is deciding whether to locate in Minnesota, but it's producing because it wants to produce something in Minnesota but selling across the country. If most of its sales are outside Minnesota, it's not going to pay tax on the profits it earns on that investment in Minnesota. But instead, those sales are going to be attributed, and the profits going to be attributed to another state. And so by eliminating the property and payroll factor, you essentially take away the sort of some of the disincentive effects of this tax to say, gee, if you invest in Minnesota, you'll pay more corporate franchise tax. If you have 100% sales and your sales are outside Minnesota, even if you invest more in Minnesota, you're not going to pay more tax as a result of that. And that's why many states have gone to 100% sales, and why Minnesota is doing that as well. But it does have an effect on the next thing, which is the incidence of the tax. And basically, the economists from the Department of Revenue and Study assumes that, you know, people pay taxes, corporations don't pay taxes, and so then you have to figure out how much of this gets passed to the purchasers from the corporation, how much gets passed back to its employees and how much gets passed back with shareholders. And if you shift more to a sales-based tax, more of it gets passed to consumers and less to the shareholders, which is why it's a capital incentive. This chart or this graph shows, as has been talked about before, that the tax is regressive. You can see that the people at the very bottom pay a higher percentage effective rate than the people at the top do. Just to put this in context, it's slightly less regressive than the general sales tax, but it's about in the same ballpark. It's, you know, the suits index on this, I think, is, you know, like 0.2 less, or I guess 0.02 less, or something like that. Next slide just shows, you know, the percent of tax paid by each of the quintiles. The next tax I want to talk about briefly is the motor fuel tax or the gas tax.
Mr. Michael, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, one of the conversations we have around the corporate rate is that when it's at such a high rate, we maybe have a higher proportion of S-corps or LLCs or LLPs, because if you're making the if you're bringing in the tax burden, you might be able to pay a little bit less if you stay in S-corp versus incorporating. How do we compare to other states that way? Do we have a higher rate? And I mean to put you on the spot for an actual number, but do we have a higher S-corp or LLC and LLP rate than maybe surrounding states that have a lower corporate rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller, that is something I've never seen statistics on. In general, there's a huge trend nationally to switch to the LLC and S-corp form if possible. And, of course, the federal tax, which has a 35% rate, and the state tax is a deduction from that, is a much more powerful driver. And, of course, once you get the legal community and the financial advisor community into that mindset, it also, that's a factor, too, even if, you know, it's not a pure financial thing for, because there are many of these smaller businesses take most of their profits out as compensation, because they're also employees of the business, and, of course, compensation is deductible. So it's only when you get amounts that you're going to keep in the business that you don't want to pay as compensation to you as profits that makes a difference. But Minnesota does have one of the highest nominal rates, obviously, as the governor has pointed out and has been talked about. And in part, that's a function of the base differences. And the main base difference, of course, is the apportionment formula. So you'll find states that use arithmetic apportionment tend to be in the West to have lower rates, because their effective rates really are going to be higher. So there's, you know, the usual base rate interaction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Turning to the motor fuel tax or the gas tax, basically the tax base is, again, gasoline and special fuel, diesel fuel, and other forms of fuel that's purchased for vehicles that are going to be used on a public highway. All of you in the debate last year are familiar with the tax rate, 25 cents for the regular rate, and then there's this debt service surcharge that right now is at a half cent and will rise to up to three and a half cents. That's a function of the amount of the bonds, but I think it's really more just what's in law, because that will follow that schedule that's set in law. The revenues are constitutionally dedicated to the Highway User Trust Fund. Local governments receive a share of those revenues. 60% of it goes to the Trunk Highway Fund. 31% goes to the counties through the county state aid formula, and the 9% goes to cities. And the only cities that qualify for this are the cities that have populations over 5,000. And they're required to use it for county roads, city streets, and so forth. The revenues from this for fiscal 09 are projected to be about $760 million. One thing to note about the gas tax and the other excise taxes, which I will talk about next, is all of these taxes are expressed as a dollar amount per unit. So the gas tax, for example, 25 cents per gallon plus the surtax. Unlike the general sales tax, for example, those per unit fixed dollar taxes do not grow with inflation. There's a number of states, for example, that impose that have lower gas taxes, but that impose their general sales tax on purchases of gasoline. I know Illinois, for example, and Indiana are examples of this, in California. That has a couple of effects. One is it's going to grow with inflation, but given the recent trend, or not just recent, but over the last, you know, 20-plus years, the price of gasoline becomes a fairly volatile revenue source, because when it goes up to $3 a gallon, your revenues really increase. When it goes down, they decrease. Our tax doesn't grow with inflation, but it's much more stable because it only drops when consumption actually drops.
Mr. Michael, we've got a question. Representative Mulley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael answered the first part of it, which was other state. How many? Well, you didn't get into how many. Basically, I was wondering how many states tax both sales tax and the motor vehicle fuel tax.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulery, I don't know that off the top of my head. I think Minnesota is certainly the more common approach, which is that there's an exemption from the sales tax. But that's something we can get and provide to the committee. There actually are, you know, more than a handful of states that do impose their sales tax. And I think there's a couple of states, New York comes to mind, that impose their gas tax on a gross receipt basis rather than a per gallon basis. So it would, that way it would grow with inflation too, as the price of oil and gasoline changes. But we can get that little comparison for you.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Turning next to the cigarette and tobacco taxes, again, this is a tax, that's a per unit tax per cigarette. The tobacco products tax, this is the tax on pipe tobacco, snuff, chewing tobacco, and so forth. By contrast, there's a gross receipts tax that's a fraction of the wholesale price, so that does grow with inflation. The basic cigarette tax rate is 48 cents for a pack of 20. The tax rate on tobacco products is 35%, but as, of course, I think most of you know, in addition to that regular tax, there's this health impact fee that was enacted in 2005 that applies at 75 cents a pack and adds another 35% to the wholesale price of tobacco products for the tobacco product tax. So the combined tax and fee is $1.23 per pack, or 70 cents as a percent of the wholesale price for tobacco products. It raises about a little over $400 million a year, and that includes the health impact fee. Most of that revenue goes into the general fund ultimately. The health impact fee goes into a health impact fund, and then it flows back into the general fund after a finding is made.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, do we have any of the data now to show how a revenue source, and this is, I'm thinking particularly the 70% tax, how our revenues have either flatlined or declined on this?
I do not have that data, but I can certainly get the numbers on the tobacco product tax over time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and let me compliment you for a freshman. I think the chair should be a little bit worried. You're in a pretty tight ship around here.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
In addition to those regular taxes, I believe in 2003, the legislature enacted an additional fee that applies to what is called non-settlement cigarettes. One of the effects of the tobacco settlement that all of the major manufacturers entered into, which really worked sort of like a national tax, because it gets passed along to consumers in higher prices of cigarettes, that naturally created an incentive for new manufacturers that would not be subject to those costs to spring up and compete against the majors like Altria and RJR. And so, as economic theory would project, a bunch of these manufacturers started up. And, of course, they could sell their product at quite a bit lower price because they didn't have to bear the cost of these settlement payments that are being made to the states. To sort of ameliorate a little bit of that effect and to sort of eliminate to the extent that the cigarette tax is intended to deter consumption of cigarettes and to compensate the state for health costs and so forth, the legislature imposed a 35-cent per pack tax on those companies that sort of partially closes the gap between the majors and those companies, and that raises about $3.5 million per year. Alcoholic beverage excise taxes, again, the same thing as the per unit, dollar amount per unit. Tax rates vary by beverage types. We have high tax on distilled spirits, relatively, compared with other states, relatively low taxes, that's $5 a gallon. Relatively lower taxes on table wine and beer. We're sort of above average on distilled spirits and below average on beer and wine.
Mr. Michael, when you put those categorizations out, is that nationally or is that regionally? Tends to be a sensitive issue for those of us in border cities.
Mr. Chair, that I'm using a national comparison. Regionally, we're Wisconsin's lower than us on both wine and beer, and I believe our other surrounding states are higher. Iowa is the only one of our surrounding states that has a liquor monopoly, and so it's hard to compare what their liquor tax is, because in order to buy liquor in Iowa, you have to buy it from a state liquor store. And there's a bunch of other states that have that model. And of course, the state essentially has an implicit tax revenue that's mixed up with the profit that they earn on it. And so it's hard to measure what it would be.
Thank you.
One thing that's worth noting, unlike the federal alcoholic beverage tax, the state tax is just based on the beverage type. It doesn't relate directly to the alcoholic content. The federal tax, by contrast, is a tax on the alcoholic content. The revenue raised by the excise tax is $76 million. Now, it's important to note that we also have, used to be a differential sales tax rate, it's now a gross receipts tax of 2.5% on the gross receipts of retail purchases of alcoholic beverages. And that raises almost as much money, a little bit less, but almost as much money as these excise taxes. These taxes, as you would expect, are fairly regressive, not as regressive, with shows it for all of the taxes. The cigarette tax is quite a bit more regressive than the alcoholic beverage tax.
Mr. Michael, we've got a question from Representative Mullery, and thank members, you. We'll try and get you the next couple slides, and that would probably be a good ending point for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real quick question, Mr. Michael. What about non-alcohol beer? Is there any kind of tax on that, sales tax or alcohol beverage tax?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, non-alcoholic beverages are subject to the general sales tax with some exceptions, but if you buy soda pop, for example, you pay the 6.5% sales tax, and that's also what would apply to non-alcoholic beer. Again, this is a similar graph that shows the percent of the tax paid by the different. The motor vehicle license tax is often talked about, called the TAB tax. And again, this was increased by the legislature as part of the transportation bill last year. The base for this is the value of the passenger vehicle. That's a measure that the manufacturer has. It's the tax rate, the dollar, up 1.25% of the base value. There's a depreciation schedule in the statute that as the vehicle ages, that tax is reduced over a 10-year period. In the 11th year, there's a minimum tax of $35 that applies. As with the gas tax, these
this tax is also dedicated to the Highway User Trust Fund, so it gets shared between the trunk highway and the counties and the cities in the same fashion. Raised a little bit less than half a billion for 2009.
Mr. Michael, why don't we end there today? Members, are there any questions before we adjourn? Again, a reminder, save these. We've got a little bit more to go, so put that in your save file, and it'll be there for you next time. And otherwise, we are adjourned. Thank you.